Grade 1 Conference, Lecture 40, Storytelling, Part 3. In your work with fairy tales this summer, you probably noticed that now and then there's a story in which a farmer or a peasant or someone very often of a humble lineage finds something exceptional. It might be a beautiful jewel, like a large emerald, or it might be a special animal, or it might be that they meet a being who can really be of great help. And what's the next step? And it might be perhaps the farmer's plow is stopped by this big mineral. So what does he do? He single-handedly, or maybe with the help of his sons, digs it out of the soil, puts it onto his wagon, and heads off to the local jeweler, undoubtedly, to sell it for a kingly sum. No. He takes it to the king. And sometimes it's really hard for him to get an audience with the king because he is such a humble soul. And he has to make all kinds of promises to the guard. So the plot really thickens. And what does he want to do with this? He wants to give it to the king. Give it to him. And even that takes some epic effort to be able to do that. So he gives it to the king. And as he's presenting it to him, or right before or right after, he will say to the king, "What is it? What is this called? What do you name this?" And the king will say, "It is a giant emerald like nothing ever seen before," or "This is a unicorn," or whatever it is. And then the peasant rests content. He doesn't necessarily want a reward, though usually one is given to him, but that's not the reason he brought it to the king. It was because by receiving it, by naming it, the king gave that whatever it is meaning. He put it in the context of meaning, which in the simple, humble life of a peasant, especially the fairy tale variety of peasant, there's not a whole lot of context. You know, you have root vegetables, you have leaf vegetables, and you've got your horse and your plow and your family, and that's kind of your context for everything. Here's something very new, very exceptional coming into life. And here I would say we find kind of the literary or even psychological correlative for the nature story. Because this is what will happen. You'll go on a nature walk with your children, and a child will come up and will hand you a nondescript little gray rock. And they will say to you, "What is that?" Or they may say, "Look, I found a feather. Look at the feather. Why is it all scrawny like that?" Or, "What kind of bird does it come from?" Or even, "Look what I found," handing you a feather. "What is it?" You don't know, especially in today's nature-deprived children, how much context they have. It's sort of the opposite of the peasant. You know, they would know what an emerald is and perhaps how much it's worth, but they might not know very much about a feather or a stone or a pine cone. Or they'll say, come, look, and there's a little hollow in a tree. And do you think somebody lives there? Well, what's your answer? So you are, and not only on nature walks, it could be in recess time, a child sees a puddle and says, "That was so much bigger this morning. Where did it go? What happened to the water in the puddle?" Or they see an interesting formation of snow, or they see a little flower popping up, and they want to share their joy with you. You are now one of the two or three most important people in their life. So you see how for the child, that experience always must have a social component, that they want to share this. But it isn't only that they want to share it with you. They'll share it with their friends, and their friends may have opinions about what it is or what it is not. But you have the final word. Whatever you say goes. And you have to recognize this is a very great responsibility on your part, because you are not only telling them this is what this is, but you are also, in a way, either cutting off the possibility for their understanding of that later on, because you've told them what it is in such certain terms, and or you are laying the foundation for something that can grow and unfold in later life. Now, this may seem awfully grandiose in terms of a child handing you a feather, but to understand what's going on here and to touch on what I believe is a vital nerve of all education, but perhaps that is more conscious in Waldorf education, was put in there in a more intentional way by Rudolf Steiner than in most educational systems, and is, again, one of these things that we kind of never talk about, that's sort of really a blind spot in our work. Like, you know, saying that Waldorf education is an education in which whatever the teacher says to the children is extremely important. Wow, that's one of our most revolutionary qualities. Here's another revolutionary quality. And it takes us back to a book that you probably studied in your training in the kind of Anthroposophy 101 segment. And I'm sure that you heard repeatedly this book is the book that Steiner said would be the only one of his books that would be read in hundreds of years. This is the most important book in Steiner's work. This is the book that Steiner revised again and again. This is the book he put the most, you know, all of this, and then you'll never hear about it again, and it's probably never mentioned in any aspect of your practical work as a Waldorf teacher. And I would say that you can't do practical work as a Waldorf teacher without understanding one of the basic postulates in the philosophy of freedom, or the philosophy of spiritual activity, Steiner's preferred mode of translating Freiheit into English. But either way, this is what it comes down to. And this is, of course, philosophy of freedom for dummies, let's say, what I'm going to give you. It's not going to be, you know, anything like the original. But just to put a thought there that you might want to follow up, and perhaps even in the course of all the leisure time you have this summer, perhaps look at this again. Rudolf Steiner speaks about, gives us sort of a triad among others in the book. He says that there is the concept. There's the concept, like let's say tree is a concept, or nature is a concept, or cloud is a concept. That it's a concept that then, in Platonic terms, has a universal validity and actually exists archetypally in the spiritual world. But that we will never see that concept. We will only see sort of broken up fragments of it called clouds. Or we will see different trees, or different houses, or different animals, or different chairs. So that in Aristotelian terms, Aristotle said, yes, but these broken up pictures, these percepts, are what lead us to understand what we mean by cloud or tree or house. And Steiner tries, I think with remarkable success, to philosophically bridge these two irreconcilable philosophical approaches by presenting a third quality. He says it's not just a battle between which is real, concepts or percepts. They are both real, but they're real on different levels. And what we do as human beings is to ceaselessly attempt to build bridges between the concept and the percept. And he called these Vorstellung or representations. And this is a word that has had many versions of translation in many editions of Steiner's work, also called mental pictures. That when I said the word cloud to you, you probably, without giving it thought, instinctively saw a cloud in your mind's eye, or tree, or house, or anything else. If I said animal, you probably saw a specific animal. But maybe it wasn't so specific that, let's say, if it was a lion, that it couldn't be turned into a tiger very readily. So we actually do carry mental images. Many of them are based on our prolonged, lifelong experiences of seeing trees and houses and chairs. You know, if somebody said to you, what is a chair? You could probably give a kind of dictionary definition. And it would be based more on your experience than on the lofty concept, which actually goes back to the hierarchy of the thrones, if you really must know. But anyway, so this is what's going on in all of our teaching, actually. We know that the children need to understand certain concepts, such as the four operations, or straight line, or curve line. We know that in their world of percept, they're only going to be able to see individual examples of this concept. And we could say it's like, you know, shattering a mirror, and suddenly you get many, many different reflections of all shapes and kinds, but it doesn't carry the integrity of that single reflection of the unbroken mirror. We want to draw the children from the world of percepts into the world of concepts. All teaching is trying to build up our life of concept, our relationship to the world of concepts. Even, you know, in completely materialistic teaching, where nobody believes in Plato's ideas at all, but still there's the recognition that there's an overriding concept, which, if understood, will help us work with, deal with, comprehend the particular examples. A big difference between the way Waldorf education works with this and the way mainstream education works with it is that we believe it takes time for a child to move into the world of concepts, that we try wherever possible not to introduce concepts, but rather to begin working with percepts. However, not with the goal of getting stuck in the percepts and just saying, okay, now you've seen 1,000 examples of this, what do they all have in common? Rather, that we speed up that process and don't need 1,000 percepts or even 100 percepts, because I, as a teacher, am introducing a mental image, a representation to the children, which builds the bridge for them that they can walk upon that takes them towards the concept. Now, we could say that the four operations anthropomorphized by Dorothy Haar, which I spoke of rather disparagingly, I will admit it, On the other hand, I would also have to say there's an example. I don't necessarily agree that it's an economical example, but there's someone who really tried to take these concepts, which for a seven-year-old are not the easiest things to understand, and certainly not their differences, four concepts, part of the overriding concept of mathematical operations, and she anthropomorphized them, and that made them more accessible and more amenable. And there are children who I would acknowledge will learn them faster and more joyfully if you tell those stories, if you create those figures. There are others who won't, but that's fine. So there's an example. And as I said, you know, you may not want to use that at all, or you may want to create your own example, and you'll see it's not so easy. You know, just making everything into gnomies and fairies, well, that starts to get old pretty quickly, and it's even not really true to the nature of those elemental beings to put them in these positions. But nonetheless, this is what we're doing. So let's go back again to that question. The child shows you a little old, weather-beaten, nondescript, totally uninteresting piece of rock and says to you with clear joy on their face, you know, I discovered this, I found this, and somehow or other it appealed to me. What is it? Tell me about it. Now, you have several options. One of them is to say, tomorrow. And, you know, you're going to have to do this sometimes. You're trying to get everybody together to go back from the nature walk, or a child is standing dangerously near the stream and it's the middle of winter. You know, all of these things. You may have to say, that is beautiful. Would you like me to hold it or put it in your pocket? We'll take it out later and we'll talk about it, or I'll tell you about it. Maybe if you do that, he'll forget and you're off the hook. But that won't always work either. So sometimes that's fine. Later, tomorrow. And believe me, I answered plenty of children. You know, I'll find out tomorrow, or let me think about that. And then the next day I came back with hopefully something worthy of their question. The second thing to do is, danger warning here, say, what a beautiful stone. Take good care of it. We'll put it on our nature table. No. Because in saying the word stone like that, you are really handing the child a concept. You are doing what Steiner was to say later, pedagogically speaking. You are here literally handing the child stone instead of bread. You're giving the child stones instead of bread, something that is dead, not because it's bad, but because it's living so high in the spiritual world that for all practical purposes, we cannot simply take it and imbue it with life and make it nourishing for the child. Better not to name it at all if you're not certain about what to say, and just say, that is very beautiful. Or, what do you like most about that? Where did you find it? You know, to give it a location and a habitation, as Shakespeare would say, that's fine. Don't give it a name. Don't rush into naming things that children give you. If they name it, that's fine. But what they're asking you for, in a way, is its true name, or at least for a mental picture that takes it out of just something I happen to pick up on the ground and makes it something that is really appealing to me, that has a connection with me. So right away we see what temperament is the child who picked up that stone. Let's see if we can bring that stone into relationship to the child's temperament. Is it a boy? Is it a girl who picked up that stone? Let's see if we can bring it into relationship with some aspect of that child's gender without being sexist. But just, we might say that For the girl, very often there's the wish to harmonize it with things around, with other things. For the boy, there's always an interest, or often an interest, in taking it apart. What's inside there? And boys will often bring you things that have the potential of being taken apart, even if they're an insect, let's say, which might not appeal to you, but definitely appeals to them. So we could say the girl tends to be more of a synthesist in things that she finds. The boy is more analytical in what he finds. And you want to work with these two poles as well. And we can say that the beeswax crayons and pieces of paper and paintbrushes that I spoke about in the previous lecture, it's very much the same, that the pictures that you're giving the children, the imaginations, the short but succinct narratives that you're giving, all of this is helping to build a bridge between the object they are about to receive, that they will be drawing with or painting with or whatever else they may do, and the meaning that it has in the world, and the concept of crayon, the concept of paper, the concept of brush. This should be in your mind. You know, am I taking this, may I say it, epistemological step with the child, which again is helping them in time to think, is helping them to develop intellectual capacities. Never forget, that's what we are doing. You know, keep the eye on the prize, that when they're in eighth grade and beyond, they're not going to be first graders anymore, and they're not going to be asking that sort of question. Are you paving the way for that to happen? So we see in even little things like this, the child handing you something she found on a nature walk, you're already in a way seeing the grand vistas of the possibilities of an educational experience. We'll go on.